Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of our Digital Dialogue series. Throughout this series, we've been speaking with some amazing activists, scholars, thinkers, organizers, all about land and our relationships to land. And we've been talking about issues like food sovereignty, food justice, Indigenous land rematriation, and relational accountability. We've also been talking about how this work is resisting against ongoing settler colonial extraction, oppression, and injustice. My name is Sarah Roth, and I'm part of the RARE Collective, which is a group of settler and Indigenous researchers, food activists, farmers, and teachers who have been working together on this research project and who have together made this series possible. So you'll be hearing many of their voices throughout this series, and today, Adrienne Lickers Xavier and I will be speaking with Tabitha Robin, who is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems at the University of British Columbia. She is mixed ancestry Swampy Cree, Métis, Icelandic, and Irish. I want to thank everybody for joining us today and sharing in these conversations. We've been sort of coming together around this project since 2019, but myself and Danielle Boisineau and some folks at the NFU, the National Farmers Union, the Indigenous Solidarity Working Group with the National Farmers Union, and Adrienne and Lauren Kepkowitz and I had been sort of talking about this project around the relationships between land. It started out as a conversation around like land sharing and rematriation and sort of brought in folks from the NFU who were really interested because there was a lot of folks in their union who were wanting to talk about land sharing, but they're largely white settler farmers. And so these conversations kind of emerged from some of that around what does it mean to move forward with those conversations in a better way, and in a way that maybe doesn't center some of the traditional like sort of settler modes of, you know, moving towards things like land trusts and things like that. So those were sort of the beginning of those conversations. And then we sort of just started to have more just explorative conversations around what does relational accountability mean as a research team? What does it mean to do this research together, or just start to build these conversations in a good way, especially as we bring in concepts and practices like food sovereignty and what's the relationship between rematriation and food sovereignty. And so everybody on the team was very quickly like, we want to reach out to folks who have been thinking about this stuff, have been living this stuff, and start to, you know, see what happens from there. I'll let Adrienne, you go ahead and sort of introduce yourself, and we could jump in from there.
I love doing these things where it's like we all sort of know each other, and we've all known each other for a long time because we were just talking earlier about how small these circles are, even though they're cross-country. Speaking of which, congratulations on your move and your new role. I'm Adrienne Xavier, Adrienne Lickers for the longest time, and all the people that sort of knew me. I officially graduated, which was super exciting this year, though none of the formal getting to go to British Columbia and celebrate it and hang out by the water or anything. But I am at home working from my desk as usual here at Six Nations, still working around all of the food things in my community partly because my mom does it, and it's something that just is central to my life. And partly because I think that there's a lot of people asking these questions, more and more students, friends, strangers. I hear you know about things about land and food and connections. So I spend most of my time at Six, partly because of COVID and partly because I'm a super homebody. When I go to Longhouse, I go to Akwesasne in Tandanega, we want to start sort of placing ourselves in that way. I know that you've moved, but I do things more like my mom did when we first moved to Canada. which was everyone that I ever met was like, who's your parents? Who's your family? And where do they come from? And that's what I ask people. Who are your people? We'll start there.
Sure. So I'm going to introduce myself first in my, using my spirit name, because that is the name that, the ancestors recognize us. And I do try and evoke the ancestors, in all the work I do. So Tansei, Spokopanisis, Natiz Nakasun. My name is Tabitha, and, a very long time ago, my Icelandic ancestors met my Cree ancestors fishing on the waters of Lake Winnipeg. And my Icelandic ancestors would not have survived without the local indigenous peoples, because they had come to Canada from Iceland. And the winters are tough in Manitoba. So I very much think of Lake Winnipeg as my homeland. And my background is, well, like many Indigenous backgrounds, is a bit, it's layered. There's complex pieces. But I also acknowledge these complexities because they're sort of part of my own story in understanding like all of the interconnections between the land and who we are and how colonialism has interrupted our families and really like, in the case of my family, I think created such a strong cycle of dependency. So it was surprising to me, I think, that when I did my master's degree, I started my master's and I had an entirely different project planned. Like my master's was on Indigenous food sovereignty, but for the first 3 months of my master's, you know, the proposal that I wrote to get into grad school was around environmental education. And I refused to do Indigenous research. And my advisor at the time, I remember we were at a coffee shop and that project fell through because Manitoba Education was doing something similar and I did not want to work with the government on my master's. And so that project fell through. And he was essentially like, why don't you do something Indigenous, you know, given that you are Indigenous? And I refused. Like I was adamant. My feet were so firmly rooted in that decision. And he said, well, we're not leaving this table until we like sort of wade through this. And when I talked to him about it, I realized that, you know, everything I had been exposed to in my undergrad about Indigenous peoples was that we were less than, you know, it was really that we were inferior, that we were troubled, that we were not okay. And that didn't, I understood that and I saw that in my family, but I also saw this other side. Like I saw that every time I went to the reserve, I left with food. That every time I went to the reserve, I was fed. I saw that there was an incredible kindness in teaching me land-based food practices, you know, and in my auntie taking me on and investing in me. Like, so I knew that there was this other part to it. And so my supervisor had said, have you heard about Indigenous food sovereignty? That like changed my life forever. So I mentioned that because it's a pretty important moment. And yeah, but I am surprised that post-secondary education would bring me closer to my culture because even the literature says there's so much distrust around it. And I think that also comes from the fact that because of my childhood, you know, and I'm a deeply introverted person. And my childhood was spent on the land or with books. Like I always buried myself in books and I took a lot of comfort in that. So I think that being able to explore my culture like through literature was also safe, like also felt safe. And so being able to bring those two pieces together, like being able to kind of read about it, but also be on the land, brought the whole piece together for me. And what I realized that I was witnessing in my family was Indigenous food sovereignty. So that's a very long answer to your question.
I like it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be really honest about it, you know, because if we are, because it didn't come easy for me, because there was a lot of heartache, because there was a lot of hardship, because my world cracked open and I began to heal, and it was sort of a surprise to me, you know, all of these pieces become, they form part of who you are, and they do inform your scholarship, and I'm grateful for it, because I think in many ways, you know, the commitment to sorting through your own history and your own trauma, you know, really informs the work I do. You know, I take a trauma-informed lens. My master's was in environment, but my PhD I did in Native studies and social work, which seems bananas. But for me, it was like I really wanted to keep exploring food in its fullest sense. And after my master's, I was like, okay, well, we can talk about some of the mechanics of a food system, right? We can start to identify what an Indigenous food system looks like, and we can start identifying like key features of Indigenous food sovereignty. But what does this mean for concepts related to well-being and particularly spiritual well-being? And so that's what I explored in my PhD. And I guess it just, everything feels so iterative when upon reflection, you know, at the time, sometimes you can't always make sense of it, but upon reflection, like all of these just form layers of how I approach my work, and why I approach my work. And I think also why I'm such a pain in the ass, maybe about the ways that I'm very frank about my own experience in colonialism and my family's experience in colonialism. I'm not afraid to say hard things out loud. But it's because of all of the pieces that have brought me here. And I just don't think you can talk about land or Indigenous food sovereignty for Indigenous people without understanding like the complexities and the nuances and the layers that are involved in this approach. And I say that because I see a lot of reference to Indigenous food sovereignty in the literature. And, you know, Adrian, if you remember last year when we sort of tried to divert funds away from the food banks, you know, in COVID, and that was unsuccessful. But what we begin to see is like all of the food banks got money to do Indigenous food sovereignty. Well, is that Indigenous food sovereignty then? You know? And so we have to like begin to ask these questions and understand like, This is so much more complex than I think I ever could have imagined. And I will continue learning forever. And even for me in doing my dissertation research, I remember feeling, even as I was putting my dissertation together, I was like, I just was stunned at how much I didn't know and how much was there for the taking. That was very surprising to me because I do spend time in the lodge and I do spend time with elders and I do spend time on the land. And I guess I was just surprised that the elders really gave me a roadmap for rebuild. And that's kind of my focus now, I think, in my work is like thinking about, you know, the elders gave me this roadmap for like rebuilding a Cree food system. And that's where my heart is. That's really where I'm most invested in. And while I don't explore land rematriation myself, I understand that it's like a significant component to what I do. So I would say that my scholarship, my personhood is interested in two pieces, and one is dismantling and the second is rebuilding. And those things have to happen simultaneously, which is basically impossible. But, you know, you still wake up and try again.
So the question I wanted to ask, and you sort of covered this, was about your relationship to land, but I'm wondering about the nuts and bolts that you speak of, or So when you're talking about rematriation, that that's like a component of how you're thinking about Indigenous food sovereignty, Indigenous food systems. Could you share more about that roadmap maybe? And when you say it has peace, I can't quite remember how you phrased it, but it has something to do with rematriation, or rematriation might be a component of it. Can you share a bit more about those nuts and bolts and where you see those relationships to land, even how you spoke about well-being? You said it so well that it's not just about, of course, it's not just about one thing. It's not just about food. It's so much bigger, right? Cultural, spiritual well-being. And then when you look at what's been all the destruction that's happened, as you say, then how do you what's your roadmap in light of all of those moving parts?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think I'm still trying to figure my roadmap out, especially because now I'm in new territory. But what I realized in moving here, and I certainly it was a difficult decision to make, but what I realized is that at a point you become an investment in your community, or you become an investment of your community. And so many people have believed in me and have invested in me with their time and energy and spirit and love and kindness and support and scolding and teaching, sharing, feeding, like all of these things. And so I think kind of two things have to happen simultaneously. Like I mentioned, like there's the dismantling that has to happen, but then there's the rebuilding. And I don't mean rebuilding as in like the physical sense on the land, but what became clear to me in my dissertation research is that in order for us to rebuild, we have to look at the cultural practices and processes that underlie Indigenous food sovereignty. And so I can think of two examples that came out of my research and then I will be exploring more thoroughly moving forward. Okay, so one example is around this concept of food literacy, right? And so I've been spending a lot of time lately thinking about like decolonizing diets and what does that mean? And what I learned in my PhD that I just can't believe I didn't know this. But so, for example, in our language, in Cree, the word for food is meechum, but the word for defecate is meechata, and to eat is meche. The origins of all of those words are the same, and that is because it is understood that food comes from the land and that waste goes back to the land to become food from the land. Colonialism has fundamentally shifted that. And if we think about the indoctrination that happened, that told us that our diets were insufficient, that they were heathen-like and savage-like, that, you know, many people don't talk about the fact that European women were charged with indoctrinating Indigenous women so that they would learn that their proper place was not on the land, but in fact in the kitchen. Well, if that message was taught to us, then what does that mean for people that are eating Kraft dinner today? Because technically Kraft dinner is made in the kitchen. Is that healthier food for us than moose, which comes from the land? That's so problematic. And so, you know, communities of color all over the world are like facing health disparities and inequities, right? And it's often understood that communities of color don't know how to properly feed themselves. And we become the targets of nutrition interventions. The problem with nutrition interventions is they lack context entirely, and they fail to consider traditional knowledge at all. I don't think that we can feed ourselves again until we come to the most complex understandings of the fulsomeness of our traditional food systems, right? So already when we look at the language and it tells us like all those origin words mean that food comes from the land, we see there's direction, that we were meant to eat food from the land and that our food, like that our waste going back to the land was also meant to be free of chemicals, free of Kraft dinner, free of all of the things that have been introduced to our diets, you know? And so I really want to push back against this notion that we need advice on how to eat, because we don't need advice on how to eat. What we need is our language to be understood as part of, and I would say as critically vital to our food systems. And so what the elders told me is like, we spend too much time. And I think this comes from the fact that Indigenous languages are endangered, and we're kind of running in there like it's like triaging, right? They're endangered. Our elders are dying. Add the context and the scariness of COVID on top of that. And it's like, well, we gotta get some of this like language education out there. But what we've done and what the elder said is, you know, because we're meeting this important need, we're translating, we're using direct translation, and we're letting English guide our teachings of the language rather than exploring what the language really means. And so what I learned is like in Cree, the name for all of the berries give direction in terms of what that berry does for us. So for example, in Cree, the blueberry is Inanimana. What that refers to actually is that the health of our people is contained within these berries. Anuskana, which is the raspberry, means eat this for good bones. All of the berries are named that way. They're not actually blueberry. It isn't a blueberry. What even is a raspberry? Like, I'm not entirely sure. But that struck me is like, oh my goodness, what we're talking about here is something so old. We're talking about something so deeply ancestral. And we're talking about the fact that our language stemmed from the land and that it contains instructions. So for me, a rebuild looks like the simultaneous work of language. Like what needs to happen in our food systems is we need to center that knowledge moving forward rather than take from like Western and Eurocentric concepts and contexts to inform our work. We need to come back to what is the most, like what is our ancestral knowledge? What are the elders telling us? So that's one example of rebuilding. The elders also talked about their concern with overharvesting. And they felt that that came from the fact that there isn't natural law is not taught in our communities to the same degree that they learned and understood that. But you know, what natural law has always told us is that if we overharvest, we've broken our deal with that animal. So if we overharvest moose, if we overharvest pickerel, what that means is that we have broken that sacred agreement that our ancestors have made with the pickerel, with the moose. We've broken it. And there will be spiritual consequences for that. And that could look like never being able to hunt a moose again. You know, what the elders say is that moose won't make itself available to you. And I realize there are just larger pieces that are underlying our food systems that don't get talked about. We really just think about food as like the applications of what is happening on the land, not the context of what is happening on the land. Does that make sense? So those are two examples of rebuilding, and that I want to explore moving forward by saying to the elders, well, how do we do this then? Where do you see those needs best made? And for me, that looks like it's going to look like some language revitalization. Maybe some work with dietitians and nutritionists so that we can remove ourselves from the colonial context. Well, we can never remove ourselves from the colonial context, but remove ourselves from the colonial imposition of a Western nutrition. So that has to happen. But then simultaneously, we've got dismantling to do. And I mean, some of that dismantling is like in our approach to how we revitalize language, right? Are we continuing to use a Eurocentric approach? Is that how we're training hunters now? So for example, hunters now have to have hunter safety in the province. Well, that means the province dictates the education for that. Why are our own people not doing that? Why are we not using our harvesters to teach harvesting to the next generations? Those are the dismantling pieces that have to be moved out of the way. And so I said earlier that it's essentially impossible to do these things, you know, to dismantle and to rebuild at the same time, but yet it's what needs to happen. We need to dismantle to remove ourselves from colonialism because it's continuing to harm us. And we need to rebuild so that we understand that our alternatives are not alternatives. They're a way of life. They center how we understand our role and our place within creation. So I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Yeah, you know, you definitely did. What you were just saying about the harvester, your point about the harvester just made me think about, I've been doing some research around the Ontario Ministry of Food and Agriculture and the sort of settler coloniality, in so many ways, of course, but just that example, what you just said about, when I would speak with folks that were working in the ministry, the sort of immediate turns and assumptions to settler colonial land relations, colonial conceptions of farming, farmers, who gets to be of what kind of food, what kind of food projects, you know, and then just this assumption of who gets to sort of decide, make decisions about land, crown land spaces, governance. And so like, even just that, your point about the harvest, like, you know, somebody who, why do you guys get to decide that? Like, why is it up to you? And I think over and over again, when I've been speaking to these people, it just really sort of reaffirms that turn to colonial logics and mentalities is just like, it's just everywhere.
I think it's so embedded and it's so like, it's become second nature that we almost don't question it. Mm-hmm. But I guess now I'm at the point where I am questioning it. I'm like, wait, it isn't working though. Like your ways are not working. So why do we keep turning to them as though they are the only option? Well, they're the only option because it's the only option that the crown will give us, right? Or that the governments will give us. Well, at what point though, do we need to step outside of that broken relationship? Because it's so fundamentally broken. And, you know, I think of like as another example, are you guys familiar with the Safe Food for Canadians Act?
Ish, yes. Yeah.
So that act actually makes it illegal for sharing of traditional food and for selling traditional food. So what that could mean is that I could go home and my family could give me 5 pounds of pickerel. And if I gave them money for that, that is illegal. So if I gave, because I can, right? Let's say that is the way that I can invoke reciprocity. That's illegal for me to do. It also means that if a hunter wants to share a moose with an elder's home, that is illegal. But the emphasis here, like really where the crown is interested is this notion of risk. Now, we were here before there were fridges. And we have all kinds of ways of preserving foods that exist outside of the colonial infrastructure. But that knowledge is entirely ignored. What's even more troubling to me, though, is that we care so much, and maybe we in this context, I should not be including myself, but the government cares so much about this notion of risk and protecting people and wildlife regarding food safety that they want to ensure that the packaging and the refrigeration and the butchering is all done in a safe way. But nobody cares if that moose is full of tumors or if those fish are bleeding out from the inside. So you could take animals who've been pumped full of hormones or antibiotics, who are full of chemicals. You can take animals from the land who have been exposed to contaminants, and that's considered safe as long as it's been like butchered and refrigerated properly. How did we lose focus of what's really important? Shouldn't we be more concerned about the fact that we're eating foods full of contaminants? So that's an example to me of a broken piece of legislation, because there was a story in, I think it was in APTN a few years back, a fish and wildlife officer, I believe this was in Alberta. I can even send you, if you remind me, I can send you the, see if I can find the link to the story. They held a 16-month sting operation to try and catch harvesters, Indigenous harvesters. 16-month sting. And in the end, they caught someone selling $90 worth of fish, and they received a fine of $1,000. So we have the resources for a 16-month sting for someone selling $90 worth of fish. And we're seeing this, like, and to me, that comes with this notion of the crown as like militancy, right? Like, we want to catch Indigenous peoples doing bad things so bad that we will invest all of our resources in it. And we're seeing that with the protesters and the land defenders right now, right? Like, that's bonkers that they're being beaten by the police, that there are shoot to kill orders in some instances for land defenders, that they are, you know, that they will be fined thousands of dollars. But then we look at the churches during the pandemic who have continued to hold services despite public health orders, who have publicly defied public health orders, and who have chosen, in fact, to take the government to court over it. What would have happened if that was a sweat lodge? What would have happened if someone found that a sweat lodge was still running during COVID? We would have been vilified. Like, this is so fundamentally racist and broken, and it is no wonder that food has become one of the most political instruments of our lives. And I don't even know that everyone is fully aware of it. That scares me a lot. Like, it scares me a lot that the crown, that the government, that the colonizers have so much influence over our day-to-day lives. It's really scary, because we don't even fully understand, like, how many people would have ever saw that, you know, that news article from APTN and are even aware of that story of that sting happening. And also, why aren't people furious about that? Like, when we talk about where we want what we want settlers to do, like, read those news stories and then be furious, write letters, complain, use your government, use your elected officials to say, like, this is racist and unjust, and we should not be using government resources to set up a 16-month sting to make $1,000. You know, like, this is so bonkers.
Tabitha, I think what you're talking about too also comes back to something else, that if you could use those same tools for people outside of our communities, not just to be angry, but to ask questions. Mm-hmm. The fact that the government used all of that money, because I remember reading that article about the sting operation, and I was just like, I'm sorry, but y'all are stupid. First of all, When the premise of our communities is to feed each other because our health and well-being is integral to our community wellness, you are missing the boat twice. Not only are you misunderstanding that we feed each other as a source of wellness and not as a source of commodity, no wonder why you managed to get a $1,000 fine for $90. Of course you did. you don't understand that what you're doing is actually trying to stop people from taking care of themselves by taking care of others. If people could understand that notion, then they also have to understand that now you have to ask how come you think, if, for example, I don't have any hunters in my house and I wanted to give someone money for hunting for me, how come if that's the only means of sharing that I can do, that's wrong? Because now you, me, the whole world has to understand that our sense of commodity is what's created that dynamic. Because the person who hunts for me, and actually it's three brothers in my case, three brothers bring my mom deer because she said something about wanting deer. And they're like, well, that's nice. And she said, well, they said, well, where's your husband? And she said, I don't have one. And they said, oh, okay, well, never mind. Then we'll drop one off at the butcher because that's our job.
Yep.
And as soon as it was their job, we've not been without venison for years, because when they hunt for their children, they hunt for my mom, because that would be like hunting for their mom. And as soon as the government, if they could, and I genuinely don't hold up that much hope for government as a body of people, if they could understand that if we were to give him money, A, it shouldn't be illegal because he still needs to survive. But B, they created a system where we have land and food systems as commodity-based systems, even if we don't think of them that way. We still have to use them that way because we exist. We can't decolonize past the system that exists. If that system is not decolonizing itself, we can only decolonize our circle. And that circle is only so big. So if that's the case, where do we go from there, right? Like, what are the questions and how does that work? Because you are all of the things that you're saying are answering the discussion that we're having from your perspective. But I'll be honest with you, I want to remember this conversation because a year from now, I want you to be able to look back and answer your own questions again. Because you're talking about the roadmap that you've been given and what the elders tell you is possible. And we're talking about land, but we're really not, right? There's always a subtext for me in all of this work and in terms of our discussion of land rematriation. What we're talking about truly is, what is your relationship to this situation? And for you, it pinpoints at food. And for me, it very often does as well. That still is my touch point for the world. But the truth of it is if we are so far out of sync with society, how come you have the position that you have teaching people in a larger social Western system? How come I'm the director of Indigenous Studies. I am working towards us being a department and changing the face of our program so that more people have access to the information in a way that we share it. Why is it that is, a hard-won struggle in Western academia, but I get calls from strangers two or three times a week? Hey, I saw an article online about this thing and about food systems. Could you just tell me more about it? Well, I don't know. I don't have my whole life to stop what I'm doing for you. But sure, why not? So a year from now, this conversation will have grown for you, for everybody. But at the end of the day, the question of land rematriation and your question of how does this food system unite with what Cree people have always known and what I know to be true today, and what language preservation, reanimation and growth could do for me as well, because they all fit together so integrally that it's exciting to watch. And I always get that nerd moment where I'm like, I see you standing on the edge of that moment, about to step into like one of the biggest fields of your life, where you're out in the forest and you see the world surrounding you and you don't have to worry because what is growing is what's supposed to, but you just have to know where to look. So It's exciting though.
You made me get a little bit teary there, but you know, because what we're talking about, Adrienne, is liberation.
Yes.
You know, that's ultimately what we're talking about. And what most people don't understand is that, like, food became a commodity, food became a weapon, food became a tool of dependency to manipulate, to destroy us intentionally. And all of these bits and pieces, the hunter safety classes, the Safe Food for Canadians Act, they continue to keep food in a colonial role, and they continue to use food as a tool of dependency. And I want liberation for my people. And that, I guess, is what ultimately keeps me in the game, you know, because this work is the best work of my life. It really is. But some days are so hard and so heartbreaking, you know, like I just wrote a paper with some colleagues on the Safe Food for Canadians Act, and one of the reviewers responded that, like, how much of this was actually on purpose? Like, how much of this was deliberate, and how much of it was just collateral damage from colonialism? What? Like, this reviewer felt it so important to have to say that. Like, I don't even know what to say about that. But then you get mired up in the nonsense of responding to that, of refuting it, of writing a letter to the editor, of that, there's my week. Well, that's great. Like, those are the moments that waste my time. And I think that bothers me a lot, because I'm tired of having to justify myself as a person. I am tired of having to say that Indigenous methods and theories and epistemologies and ways of knowing are real. Like, fundamentally, that is because these systems, these colonial systems, have told us that everything we're doing is wrong. Well, I just call bullshit on that, because if everything we were doing is wrong, I can tell you I wouldn't be here as a person. Because my family had every reason in the world to just essentially combust prior, you know, to this moment. And it never happened. And it didn't happen because I went back to the land. I went back to my community. I went back to my teachings. I went back to my understanding of my role as a Cree person. And that, to me, like, that is liberation. That is what I want. You know, when I think about land rematriation, I was listening to a podcast with my supervisor, Michael Hart, and he was on a podcast called Two Crees in a Pod. And he said, I was just listening to this, and like, I can't, it's one of those moments that hasn't been able to leave me. But he said, you know, I'm starting to question whether or not it's true that as Indigenous people were removed from the spirit, like removed from spirit. He said, because if we are spirit and everything around us is spirit and everything we do is spirit, is it that we're not connected to the spirit, or that we don't know how to recognize it? And I can't stop thinking about that. Because the reason that we don't recognize it is colonialism. Because if you create a system of dependency, because if you create a divisive system that tells us that it is settlers versus Indigenous people, if you create a system that says to us, you are lucky to get the scraps that you get to survive, if you get a system in which Canadians are like, say, well, you get too much free stuff, you get free school and you don't pay taxes and free healthcare, well, you know, there are parts and pieces to that system that you clearly don't understand if you think that it is like superior or even on par to what the rest of Canadians receive. I just worry about like all of those pieces make this work so much harder. And I know you had a question about that, right? About like, what do I foresee? Well, if I think about land rematriation, if I want to be entirely honest, I see settlers shutting down. I honestly see more tactics that are going to further the divisiveness. I think we're going to see a lot of what we're seeing that is happening to the land defenders right now. And it scares me. I think people are going to shut down, and I think they're going to be angry, and I think they're going to come at us with everything they have. That makes me really sad. So there has to be like, I guess I come back to this notion of dismantling and rebuilding at the same time.
When you were talking about, I can't think of anything else other than sort of the fierce, like, violence of settler colonialism in terms of, I mean, like, even just saying land theft isn't enough. It was so much bigger than that. But and the weaponization of food in all the different ways. I think about, too, that while that weaponization is happening, settlers are also doing all this stuff to accumulate their own wealth and to mm-hmm. build their own food. You know, something I talk a lot about in my classes and is like, it's not just about like destruction, like causing such violence, but it's also about accumulating so much stuff for ourselves, yeah. right? Like wheat, you know, wheat, and then we've got cattle, and then we've got corn, and then we've got soy. These are like huge infrastructures of colonial like wealth and violence, both in terms of like ecological and human violence. But mm-hmm. so I'm just, and then now settler like empires or like governments then now have huge investments in those systems now. So then when we talk about decolonization, then it's like, okay, but we also have all that though. Like we have the mine, you know, we have a bunch of investment in mines in the north, and we have all, you know, there's so much like colonial infrastructure, and then that's rooted in these mentalities of commodification. So I get a little like despairing about that of like what, and so I guess I want to ask you like what your, where you see in terms of like land back, in terms of rematriation within those infrastructures, within the politics of those infrastructures, what are some of your like concerns around that, but also like what responsibilities do settlers have to dismantle that? When you talk about dismantling, like I just see so much of that stuff behind settler ignorance, yeah. right? There's like ignorance plus infrastructure plus interest plus education, you know, settler education. And anyways, I would just wonder if you have thoughts around, I'm sure you have thoughts, but yeah.
So I think like, it makes me think of the concept of communitism and then individualism, right? And so I guess my hope is that settlers understand that they've been sold a narrative on individualism, right? And that's really based on meritocracy, like this notion that if you work really hard and you show up to work on time and you cross your T's and you dot your I's, you will be rewarded in life. That is not true if you are an Indigenous person. And in fact, not true for many, you know, Black Indigenous people. So what is so different about Indigenous culture as compared to this like individualistic merit-based notion of self is that my success hinges on the well-being of my community. And like Adrian was saying, the example of the hunters, right? Taking on that role of feeding, that's a perfect example. I can't eat if you can't eat. Imagine if those notions of communitism, this understanding that we are context and that we are interconnected beings with each other and our surroundings and the sun and the moon and the skies and the stars, all of it. We are part of that piece. And what we do as an individual matters less than what we do as a member of our community. that has to fundamentally change. Like if you don't, if you can't capture that, if you cannot make yourself aware of that, these worldviews are going to just keep smashing against each other, just again and again and again. So there has to be a process of unlearning. And you know, when you talk about all of that colonial infrastructure, why is that there? The goal of the first colonizers was to be the original inhabitants of Turtle Island. They wanted to be the indigenous people of Turtle Island by eradicating the lands of its original inhabitants so that they could essentially pull off the doctrine of discovery. And we've never questioned that, right? Like, I think about even just my own experiences in high school. What did I learn about indigenous anything? I didn't. And yet the doctrine of discovery is still taught, despite the fact that we know that it was incorrect, that it is fundamentally flawed. So there has to be a commitment to like significant unlearning, like the kind of unlearning that should scare you and leave you unmoored. That has to happen. And I know that it makes people angry, and I know that it makes people uncomfortable and sad and scared. And it's no different for us. Like, it's no different for Indigenous people, you know? Though all of those systems were put in place to deliberately make us dependent. And all that colonial wealth that you're talking about, I see as just evidence. We were here. We were here. Look at how we use the land, right? If we even think back to like colonization's original notion of agrarian labor, which said that in order to deserve the lands of Turtle Island, you had to learn, you had to use them. And we were not using them according to agricultural standards to their fullest capacity. Well, look at the mess we're in now. It turns out that, in fact, we probably should have been taking that level of direction of land engagement and harvest and you know, the ways that we interact with the land in such a way that we're receiving from. Well, we're kind of hooped, you know, that, and that's the truth of where we are right now. So why are we not turning to other ways of understanding this mess that we're in and of finding new routes forward? So I think you have to be willing to have your worldview smashed into pieces.
I don't know
how many people are willing for that.
There's a shockingly open perspective that I find in different age groups right now. And it truly is across the span of generations, because I taught the intro course last year. So my class's Introduction to Contemporary Indigenous Issues, which I just feel like is such a farce in some ways, and in other ways is so absolutely vital. I'm so torn about it. But the fascinating part is I explain to students that I am going to be walking you through the Canadian corn maze of, this is the government that you trust and believe in, and here's what they did, and you've learned that history, and how do you reconcile yourself first before you ever start to help other people? How do you figure out where you fit in that system? And students are the ones that across the board are saying, this isn't acceptable to me. What more do I need to know, and where can I get the information to understand that Indigenous people have more of the answers than the answers that I am getting from the government now? And I'm more and more impressed and hopeful that there's a generation of people that are, while they aren't sure yet what to ask, what their approach is instead is to sit and listen and to learn from Indigenous elders, and asking other people to be willing to let them sit and learn from them, and what can they learn, what can they do. And that's a growing trend that I've seen in the last 3 years. And I will confess, there's those moments where I'm like, that's nice, but what's going to happen from it? Until I remember that when you are part of the operating system of Canada and you're coming to it from a 4-year degree, But when you get to the end of it, you realize, and you've known since the first year when you took those intro classes, that you would like to go on in the world and make it different. And that's where we're getting not just Indigenous people standing at Land Back. That's where we're getting people who would like to become lawyers to work with Indigenous communities, people who would like to become agriculturalists who understand true soil composition, people who want to know what it means to be connected to land. And our collective is a perfect example of the intricacies of that conversation. What do we need to do, and who are we sharing knowledge with, and where else can we find that? Because at the end of all of this, that's where this is going. I'm astounded how many people are coming to the political questions with, how are we going to feed people? Because the pandemic has made so many issues, because the cost of food is rising, our access to it is changing, and Indigenous people, we had a system, we still have a system. It might look the way that you think it's supposed to, but it's not operating that way. So there are a lot of people who are blowing their own minds up at home, asking questions, doing work and digging. I got a phone call today from a lady who writes for a magazine, and she got my mom's name and phone number because my mom is friends with a farmer who lives near the reserve. And he has spent the last, 2.5 years trying to make his very, like, relatively in terms of Southern Ontario, very small farm sustainable. So he has sheep, he has cows for butchering, and he still exists in the larger market. He keeps chickens, but he also has goats. And he's figured out that he knows how to care for his land, just his own, by creating an economy with the Indigenous community and communities around him, so that his circle is smaller, but his reach is farther when it comes to people and about having this conversation. But when you speak, I can hear the world growing, and it's beautiful. Thank you very much for today. This was really, truly very wonderful.
Thanks for asking, like, really important, difficult questions, you know? Like, it's fun to talk about this stuff, really.
It is.
I feel like a lot of it is, you know, because I consider myself an interdisciplinary scholar, and it almost feels like a puzzle that I'm putting together, you know? The more I, like, you know, the more you learn, you're kind of like, oh, I see where that connects to this. And I feel like so much of my job is about making, like, my commitment to making those connections. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Thanks for doing good work.
I want to close by thanking Tabitha for your amazing work and for offering your thoughts and your experiences and your wisdom with us. I feel incredibly grateful to be able to share in this conversation with you. I hope everyone checks out our upcoming dialogues with other amazing activists and scholars. And I'd like to also thank my fellow collaborators and friends, Taryn Giacomini, Lauren Kepkowitz, Danielle Boissonneau, Adrienne Lickers Xavier, and Ayla Fenton. And thank you to all of our research assistants, Stephanie Morningstar, Sonia Hill, and Jessica Ross. And thank you, Jaron Richards, for your wonderful media and tech support. We'd also like to thank the National Farmers Union Indigenous Solidarity Working Group for your ongoing support and collaboration. And thank you to the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council for your funding support. Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening, and tune in again soon.